At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We try real hard not to raise your economic hopes in vain, but you put two and two together today and it just might add up to some good news in housing. Also, WWWBD, what would Warren Buffett do? From APM, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Monday, the 27th of February today. Good to have you with us. As you know from listening to this podcast, of course, the monthly home sales report is actually more than just a home sales report. Real estate has a whole lot of industries depending on it. That's why we spend so much time trying to decipher the way the American housing market is headed. And for the past 4, maybe 5 years, the answer has been easy. Down. Lately, though, there have been some glimmers of hope and some more promising news today, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler tells us.
The number of people signing contracts to buy a home was up 8% last month compared to the same time last year. That's according to a new report by the National Association of Realtors. Chief economist Lawrence Yoon says data shows consumer activity in housing is higher than it's been in 5 years.
This is implying that it is a genuine recovery, and the factors for improving home sales, such as job creation, rents rising, stock market being very high levels, all these factors would contribute to more people coming into the housing market.
Others interpret recent reports on housing as good, but not amazing.
None of the numbers suggest anything like a boom.
Housing consultant Thomas Lawler expects a moderate increase in home sales this spring, but because the inventory of vacant houses has fallen so low, even a moderate increase could have big repercussions.
If sales actually do come in decent, they don't have to explode upward, but just decent, with such a low inventory, that will actually spur more building.
That would be great for the economy. More building means more construction jobs and possibly even more retail jobs. Today, the home improvement chain Lowe's reported its latest quarter was more profitable than analysts had expected. Some of that is because folks have been taking advantage of unusually warm weather to tackle household construction projects. But consumers are also spending more at hardware stores to fix up a home before or after a sale. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The big happening over the weekend for the stock picking types among you came early Saturday morning when Warren Buffett released his annual letter to shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway. He talked about his investments, as he always does. He said his successor's already been picked. Didn't say who it is. Apparently, even the chosen one, capital C, capital O, doesn't know it yet. Everybody on Wall Street watches the Buffett letter the same way the rest of us watch Apple's newest product launch. There's hype and anticipation, excitement, a lot of sleuthing to figure out what it might be. But why? Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore has that story.
Investors comb over Warren Buffett's annual letter like detectives following a trail of evidence. the 81-year-old investor gave them a really juicy clue. The company has chosen his successor. But that's not why Whitney Tilson analyzed every word of the report.
There's just a lot of wisdom that can help you just think better.
Tilson manages more than $200 million, and Berkshire Hathaway stock is his biggest investment. He considers the report an education in business, the same way Apple fanatics hung on every word uttered by Steve Jobs.
I was able to learn investing by reading all of Buffett's letters back to 1958, by attending his annual meetings every year for the past 13 years.
David Cass is a professor at the University of Maryland's Smith School of Business. He said this year's report had a surprising stock tip.
He made some very positive comments about the banking sector having recovered. It's in much sounder shape now than it was earlier.
Buffett has poured billions of dollars into Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan. No wonder he raved about them. He did eat some crow. He said he was dead wrong in predicting a housing recovery. Investor Michael Yoshikami says Buffett's mistakes are often more educational than his successes.
People look forward to someone who's been a brilliant investor for decades admitting they're wrong.
But he's still an elusive genius. Today, he said his successor doesn't know he's been chosen. How mysterious. In New York, this is Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Today, the TransCanada Corporation said it's going to go ahead with part of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. The part that's already got a regulatory green light is going to take oil from Oklahoma to Texas. It's not going to change the oil supply any, but the already political pipeline is just another indicator of the election year curiosities of energy policy. Over the weekend, Newt Gingrich was stumping in front of signs that promised gas at $2.50 a gallon. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro set about finding out exactly how that dream might come true.
Say you drive to work tomorrow and it's real. Gas is $2.50. The average driver would save about $20 per tank. And over the course of a year,
they're going to pick up somewhere between $750 and $1,000 in new money in their pocket,
says UCLA economist Matthew Kahn. Double that if you're a two-car household. But
I don't think that that alone is going to lead them to jumpstart the economy.
Economist Paul Sullivan at the National Defense University says if he woke up to $2.50 a gallon, he'd suspect government price controls like the Nixon era.
And that distortion is going to cause more refineries to shut down because they're not going to be making the profits.
Cheaper gas, but less of it. Shortages even. No one is talking price control on the campaign trail. They're talking good old supply and demand. So when did the market last bless us with $2.50 gas?
Was in mid-2009, during the trough of the recession.
Economist Gregory Dako at IHS Global Insight says prices fell because people lost jobs, didn't drive as much.
If you have weak demand, you tend to have downward pressure on prices.
But who wants to wake up to that? Energy analyst Steve Levine has another quick route to $2.50 a gallon.
The whole city of Los Angeles and New York stopped driving.
Well, Levine says the reality is no one president can get gas down to $2.50, really. It's just an idea planted in voters' consciousness.
It's called Inception.
I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, flat, and flat some more. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, the United Nations tells us, 7 billion people now living on this planet. By the middle of the century, it's going to be 9 billion. And among the many, many questions that that raises is how we're going to feed them all. The answer is complicated. It's a mix of politics and culture, science and traditions that all affect the global food supply. Today, for our series Food for 9 Billion, John Miller takes us to Bangladesh, where climate change is threatening the very delicate balance between bumper crops and disaster.
In case you hadn't heard, Bangladesh is one of the world's great food success stories. In the 1970s, famine killed more than 1 million people, but since then, the country has made huge strides. It's still extremely poor, But incomes are up, malnutrition is down, and the population growth rate is about half what it was a generation ago. And it produces enough rice, the staple food, to feed just about everybody, which is no small feat since it's got half the population of the United States crammed into a space the size of Iowa. The question now is whether climate change will sweep those gains away. People tell me if I want to see what Bangladesh is up against, I should head down to Gabura Island in the Bay of Bengal. So I hire a car and ride for hours on narrow, tree-lined roads through a world that's half land and half water, with rice paddies and fish ponds and just plain pond ponds. I stop at a concrete pier, step into a wooden boat, and chug about 15 minutes across a gray channel. On the island, I find a motorcycle taxi, climb onto the back, and bump along on a built-up track through what used to be shimmering rice fields, but now is a wasteland of salt flats and mud. That's where I find Muhammad Shikender Ali, a small man with a thin white beard, standing in what's left of his rice paddy, hacking at the bank with a short-handled hoe. He cuts a wedge of earth and lifts it into a bowl he's fashioned out of a rice sack and sticks. When the bowl is full, his son, Salahuddin, hoists it onto his head, walks about 30 yards to a tiny house, and dumps the mud outside the door. Then he comes back for another load. This is one way to prepare for climate change. You build an earthen platform to raise your house a few feet off the ground. That way, the next time a cyclone comes and the sea rises and breaks the embankments and floods your land with salt water, you might not lose everything you own. I asked Shikender if he figures his family will be safe here now. That, he says, depends on God, but also on some basic engineering. The trick is not to raise the house too high, because then the next storm will just blow it over. So, pick your poison, wind or flood. That's the sort of choice people are having to make in Bangladesh these days, because almost everything that climate change is expected to bring is already here. Stronger and more frequent storms, erratic rainfall, salty soils that make it impossible to grow crops. And the scariest thing is looming on the horizon. If the sea level rises as much as many scientists expect it to, about 3 feet over the next 90 years, one-sixth of Bangladesh could go underwater, and 15 million people will have to leave. Most of them will be farmers. They won't be producing food, and they'll need to eat.
Food security is the biggest challenge for us, ensuring food security for the people. There is tremendous, tremendous threat posed by climate change.
That's Hassan Mahmoud, a former environmental activist who's now the country's environment minister. I'm lucky to catch him in his office in Dhaka. He's been traveling the world raising the alarm and trying to raise money.
Global community has been talking a lot, but delivery is very little.
Bangladesh has a detailed plan for how to adapt to climate change. It says it needs $10 billion right away to pay for things like shoring up seawalls and building cyclone shelters. Then billions more every year after that. So far, it's raised a few hundred million.
We have been trying to help ourselves, but we cannot tackle the total scenario, and we are not responsible for this scenario. So we need the assistance from the global community.
Over at the U.S. Embassy, David Yangan of the U.S. Agency for International Development says the United States has boosted aid for Bangladesh significantly, although not as much as the government here would like. Some of it's for straight-up disaster preparedness, but a lot of it's to try to help farmers cope with the change in climate, like supporting research into rice varieties that can tolerate flooding or salt.
The other thing that we're really trying to do here is diversify away from an agricultural economy so dependent on rice. So we're very much trying to promote fish farming as well as horticulture. The more we can diversify, the more they will be resilient to these type of climatic shocks.
I think in many ways Bangladesh is a laboratory for climate change.
John Duxbury is an agriculture specialist at Cornell who's been working in Bangladesh since the 1990s.
If we can succeed in Bangladesh, we can succeed in many other parts of the world in addressing climate change for agriculture.
Duxbury says a good place to start is by getting more out of what's already there. For instance, his research group found that just adding lime to soils in northern Bangladesh, where most of the country's food comes from, can increase crop yields by more than a third.
There's many techniques, some of which are fairly simple, which we can currently apply to increasing food production. Liming is one, shifting to crops that use less water. The environment is one that can be highly productive for agriculture.
Of course, that environment is changing, so people have started planting vegetable gardens on rafts that float when there's a flood. Others are converting rice fields into ponds for fish or shrimp, although that's rarely an option for the poorest farmers.
More than sort of one great big solution, I think there's going to be lots of little solutions to specific problems in specific places.
No one I talk to can say whether all those little solutions will be enough. In fact, most are pretty pessimistic, especially about the rising sea level. The consensus is that the best way to deal with climate change is to keep it from happening in the first place. But Bangladesh has little power to do that, so people here do their best to adapt. One afternoon, I visit a village in the south. Last year, a storm surge crashed through an old concrete barrier. The villagers demanded a new one. The government said it would design it if the community did the work. And so here they are, hundreds of them, in bare feet or flip-flops, carrying sandbags, helping out on a makeshift pile driver. There may not be much money here, but in the most crowded country in the world, there are plenty of people willing to pitch in. In southern Bangladesh, I'm John Miller for Marketplace.
Our series, Food for $9 Billion, is a partnership with Homelands Productions, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and PBS NewsHour as well. There's much more on our website, a slideshow from Bangladesh and the other stories in our series. It's marketplace.org. Coming up,
people go shopping, we spend on so many things, and we just don't know. We don't know the prices of things. But gasoline, even when you're not buying, it's staring you in the face.
In really big numbers, too. But first, yeah, let's us do the numbers. Oh, so close to 13,000, but again, no dice. The Dow Industrials slipped a point, basically flat, 12,981 today. The Nasdaq inched up 2 points, less than a tenth percent, 2966. The S&P 500 up a point, that's a tenth percent, ended things at 1367. The encouraging home buying trends we told you about lifted the market out of its early doldrums. Blue chips that depend on consumer spending performed well. American Express added 1.6%. Walt Disney shares tacked on 0.8%. Warren Buffett made the financial news rounds today discussing his annual letter to shareholders. Berkshire Hathaway shares gained 0.3%. That is $350 if you happen to hold one of them. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for January. That's stuff that's supposed to last more than 3 years, you know, like a blender. The Conference Board issues its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And President Obama addresses the United Auto Workers at the Union's National Community Action Program Conference in Washington. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're launching a new project on the broadcast today. I say project because it's more than just a series or a couple of stories. It's years worth of coverage of wealth and poverty in this country.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
Our Wealth and Poverty Desk is going to explore the growing economic disparity in the United States, its causes and its consequences. Those are big ideas, big concepts, and they sound a bit sweeping, grand even. So we thought a good place to start would be with us, how we go about our economic lives, depending on our place in that economy. Today, two people from a group often classified as the working poor, above the official poverty line, not far enough above, though, to be middle class.
My name is Daryl Snell. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm 43 years old.
My name is Angel Rogers. I'm currently living in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm at the age of 41 years.
I'm a server, and I make about $20,000 a year.
My household income is $21,000 a year, and I work at Walgreens Pharmacy. I'm a pharmacy technician.
When I was growing up, I guess I was in with the poor kids. I mean, money was always an issue.
I was working class. My mom had 11 kids, you know.
If I lost my job today, I think I could make it 3 months.
2 months.
That would be the extent of it, though.
Yeah, I have to work very hard for what I want. And it's almost like teeth and nail.
My last impulse buy was a cast iron Dutch oven.
I just don't get it.
That was on sale over the Christmas holidays.
I really don't.
And now I have two.
I want to become a registered nurse. Continue to go into school to get my bachelor's. Maybe teach nursing school. I'm not where I want to be.
I have absolutely no savings. I think there might be $50 in my savings account. I'm going to work until the day I die.
I have whatever that I have left over, penny pension or whatever. Not much, but I have a couple of pennies. Not much.
I clip coupons. I buy in bulk and freeze things. I have a huge pantry. That's how you make it.
Trust me, I do believe that money is a part of happiness, because if you don't have it, you can't do the thing that you need to do. My biggest worry
about money is not having enough.
Especially to save on a rainy day.
I'm terrified of losing my home.
I have a 23-month-old son, and he's totally dependent on me.
I want to be able to stand on my own two feet. I think the income gap is ridiculously growing. I don't understand what makes a CEO think that his job is worth 700 times more than the person working on the factory floor. What is it that you do that gives you 700 times more wages?
The rich guy, he did what it took to get there. Either he worked hard as a child, or maybe he inherited from family that worked hard. America, this is a land of opportunities for anybody. And there's no excuse for nobody. You just have to get up and work hard at it. I believe that I will be very successful. No matter what detour I have, I just get back on the right track and I go for that.
Coming up tomorrow, Voices from the Middle, what it's like to live on the median income for American households. Crude oil closed down today, first time in a week that's happened. Gas prices, though, yeah, still going the other way, despite what Eve Troeh was telling us earlier about Newt Gingrich's plans. And yes, gas prices are crazy-making, I grant you that, but do a little math with me here for a second. A gallon of regular unleaded costs 14 cents more today than it did last week. So you say your tank is 16 gallons, you fill up once a week, that means net out-of-pocket increase to you is $2.24, just about what you might spend at Starbucks every day. And yet, gas prices are just one of those things. Sindel Mulanathan teaches behavioral economics at Harvard University. He's here to talk about that a little bit. Sindel, how are you?
Good, Kai. You ever wonder why there's such a big furor about gas prices recently?
No, because gas is expensive, man, and I have to fill up the minivan, and it costs me $60. That's why there's a furor.
First of all, you shouldn't have a minivan, Kai, but we can talk about that some other time.
All right.
But it is interesting because it's only one price out of so many prices out there. And it's funny that we end up focusing so much on this particular one.
Well, so here's my theory, right? And you're the behavioral economist, but it's because we see it all the bleeping time, right? I mean, I can tell you chapter and verse what gas is on my way to work, but I don't necessarily know what the price of a dozen eggs is.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's the most interesting part of this story. So they do these amazing studies where they catch people coming out of supermarkets and they take the receipt and they look at them and say, you know, you just bought some toothpaste. How much did it cost? People have no idea.
Not a clue, yeah.
People go shopping. We spend on so many things, and we just don't know. We don't know the prices of things. But gasoline, even when you're not buying, it's staring you in the face. And psychologists call it the salience. And the salience of gas prices, I think, makes it such a focal point in the debate.
Does salience literally mean how present it is in society or how salient it is to our lives? Because if I'm taking mass transit in Manhattan, I don't care what gas prices are, right?
It's both how present it is and how important it is. For example, low-income people know the prices of everything they buy because it matters to them.
Right.
Middle-income and higher-income people, we can afford not to know. And so it's partly that. But partly, it's amazing, even when the $100 doesn't take a big bite of your paycheck, because I know you're getting wealthy off of public radio.
Public radio, that's right.
It's still being able to see it repeatedly. So there are some great studies on alcohol. If you add the taxes before and you see it in the sticker price, people respond to it. But if it's added after, people don't really respond as much. So there is just a, is it there at all? That's pretty important.
Here's another question, though. How come, and we're seeing now in California, we are seeing 435. I saw 439 for regular on the way in, which is approaching where it got the last time it hit the highs. So I'm aware of it. I'm seeing it, but I'm not outraged yet. But when it hits 475, people are going to be PO'd. You know what I mean? What's the thing about, well, we've seen this price before. It's no big deal. But a new high is a new high.
I think there are two elements here. One is the new high, and in many, many places, their sort of reference points get set. Once you've seen a house sell at $500,000,
right,
selling it back at $475 is hard. But the other element of it is there are these discrete points. $5 is it's almost like the stock market. Oh, wow, we've broken through $5. Mm-hmm. And in marketing, you definitely see this. Things that price at $499 sell very differently than things that price at $5.
Are we better consumers if the price of toothpaste was in 8-inch high letters on the shelves? I mean, would that make us smarter and better?
I think in a very narrow sense it would, and that's what I think some economists think of it as. Oh, now I pay attention to prices. Mm-hmm. But if you zoom back a little bit and think of it almost like a behavioral economist, you would say, I have a limited amount of attention. Is that really how I want to focus on it? And even gas prices, you often wonder about that. For somebody for whom they're going to buy a certain amount of gas irrespective of the price, should they really be spending so much time thinking about the price of gas? It doesn't affect anything they're going to do.
Right. You got to buy gas, you got to buy gas, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Sendhil Mullainathan, he teaches behavioral economics at Harvard. Sendhil, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, some legislators in Wyoming are taking no chances should the American economy get worse, much worse, one assumes. There's a bill pending in the Wyoming House that authorizes creation of an alternative currency should things go kerflooey. An amendment approved last week on that bill also allows for Wyoming to hold its own military draft, raise and maintain a standing army, acquire strike aircraft, and get an aircraft carrier as well. I thought that last one was kind of interesting because Wyoming's pretty much landlocked, right? I thought so. I don't know. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow slipped a point, basically flat. The NASDAQ up 2 points, less than a 10%. The S&P 500 up a point, 0.1%. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up tomorrow morning on the Marketplace Morning Report for our Wealth and Poverty Desk, what is poverty? I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.